You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Robert Schneider, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 28, the 1978 production of Ain't Misbehavin'. The first two interviews that you're going to hear were collected from the podcast Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, and they are with original cast members of Ain't Misbehavin', Andre DeShields, and Ken Page. And after that will be our interview that was conducted with the author of that chapter, Richard Duenas Morrison. Thank you, and enjoy the podcast. And then after The Wiz comes Ain't Misbehavin'. Is that right?
Yes. After The Wiz comes Ain't Misbehavin'.
And telling the stories in song of Fats Waller, did you grow up listening to that music?
I did not grow up listening to a Fats Waller score.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But certainly in my house, my father and my mother would sing songs from their youth.
Right.
And one of them, first of all, was Black and Blue.
Yeah.
My mother would sing Black and Blue. Ain't Misbehavin' was one.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother wanted to dance.
Yeah.
My mother would dance the Snake Hips.
Really?
Now, if you recall Ain't Misbehavin', my tour de force moment, my stop the show moment in Ain't Misbehavin' was as the Viper to a song called The Viper's Drag Reefer's Song.
Mm-hmm.
It was a conflation of two moments. One, the instrumental from Fats Waller, and the dance from Snake Hips Tucker. And, of course, this is the man who hits himself in the head often. So I'm hitting myself in the head again. This is what my mother used to do around the house. I certainly don't mean to diminish the contribution of Arthur Faria, the choreographer of Ain't Misbehavin'. He's the one who taught us all what we had to do from the perspective of period.
Yes.
And he's also the one who trained in Balinese dance.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at Ain't Misbehavin', when you look at the Viper, and you see all the flourishes in the fingers, that's Arthur Faria teaching Balinese dance. Oh, wow. But when you see the hips rocking, that's my mother.
That's your mother. She finally got on stage.
She did.
Yeah,
she did.
She finally got on stage.
We could not have at the time told you the exact path Ain't Misbehavin' was going to take, but we all knew that we were cooking something special. We're back at the cauldron. We've got a recipe that really has something never before experienced. And the proof of the matter is that what critics wanted to categorize as a review took the Tony for Best Musical. Now, to be a musical, you have to have a story. You have to have a book.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put up Ain't Misbehavin', all you get is a score. But in that score are the connective tissues, are the interstices, I think that's the term, that give you a complete narrative, that connect the songs in such a way, because the songs are stories unto themselves.
Completely. Yes.
But when you connect those stories, you get a look at the complete life of this jazz and comedic genius, who it was Thomas Fats Waller.
Brilliant.
Ain't Misbehavin' was the perfect show, not only because of the cast. The other storytellers were Nell Carter, Ken Page, Amelia McQueen, Charlene Woodard, and Andre DeShields.
And Andre DeShields.
Now yes, please. Yes, sign me up.
And preserved on film, correct?
Well, yeah, preserved on film for television.
Yes, right.
Yes,
but still, there's a
record. Well done,
very well done
with a live audience on the NBC soundstage that Johnny Carson would do his show on.
Oh, I did not. Yeah,
and they built a cabaret
on
the soundstage.
That's wonderful.
And we performed the show for a live audience. And one of the issues was how do we do the Viper's Drag, which starts stage right and moves stage left. Now, you could put up a long shot, but it would look very flat.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the gentleman's name, but I remember his Herculean task to put a camera on his shoulder and follow me. And then when you watch it, you don't see any jiggling except for the hips.
Yeah, yes.
That's the jiggling you want to see. But it's as if there was a camera on a tripod. But that's a man.
That's a man holding that.
With a camera on his shoulder.
Before Steadicam.
Before Steadicam. It's preserved beautifully. And it is, sorry, going back to what you were saying before, it is the perfect review.
Can you tell us a little bit about Harlem Nocturne you did? Yeah, in 1984,
I should say to you that Ain't Misbehavin' was based on an idea by Murray Horowitz.
Haven come any easier for you?
Yes, again, in a certain way. I mean, they asked, I like to joke that it went out on the wire that they were looking for someone sort of like the guy who played Nicely in Guys and Dolls.
We'd like a Ken Page type.
We'd like a Ken Page type.
It always cracks me up when casting does that. You're like,
and I thought, well, what about me?
Ask Ken. Maybe Ken's interested.
Well, I think because it was off-Broadway, and it was, you know, the Manhattan Theater Club was not the Manhattan Theater Club we know now then. And I had been in The Wiz and Guys and Dolls. I think they kind of thought, well, he probably won't do it. But somebody like that, that was their thinking, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I ain't doing nothing. I wasn't working at the time. I'd left The Wiz. And long story, I went over and auditioned, blah, 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 blah. And when they called about it, they said, we have Andre DeShields, who, of course, I had done The Wiz with, Nell Carter, who I knew from the cabaret circuit in the city. She used to do her act at Reno Sweeney's and all the different places. And I knew him. She was in those infamous shows like Dude.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You know, Iphigenia.
Yes.
You know? Dude. I always teased her about
that. Stage.
It's a Don't Get Grand With Me. I know you were in Dude.
Don't Get Grand With Me.
you were in Dude, you know. And she'd go, don't bring that up.
I totally forgot she was in that, too.
Oh, she was in Dude, and Out of Town, and Miss Moffat.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew who she was. I knew the history. So, at that time, Irene Cara, who, I knew from Me Nobody Knows, I guess, whatever she did. And Amelia McQueen, who I didn't know, but I knew she'd been in the movie of Sparkle. Mm-hmm. And I knew she was Toon Ann in the movie. So you kind of knew who the other people were. And it was one of those experimental things where you thought, well, you know, they're not paying anything. What am I going to get out of this, you know? Right. And I thought, oh, well, what the hell. Now, what happened right before the audition was that Twyla Thorpe's company had done a dance to Your Feet's Too Big, and it was on PBS. And a friend of mine called me because they had a big picture of Fats Waller in back of the dance thing and the scenery, I guess. And they called me and said, there's a man's face on the screen right now on PBS, and it looks just like you. I thought, that is not good news. You know, and they said it was Fats Waller, blah, blah, blah. So I had actually started researching to do a one-man piece about Fats Waller.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, you know, I found out who he was and everything. And true enough, I certainly knew I could do it, you know.
Right.
But he was, of course, a piano virtuoso, so I don't play the piano. That was just a little minor thing. And right after that, this came up. So it was kind of fortuitous and, you know, just sort of serendipitous and all those words. And when I went over and they called and they said, these are the people we have, and I said, yes. And with that one, we got in the room and really created from scratch. That was really created organically.
Yeah. When we had Richard Maltby on, he spoke at length about the rehearsal process. Tell us from your point of view, what's it like? So we'll take Your Feet's Too Big as an example, which is pretty much a standalone song until it's now in the context of the show. So now you need to take a standalone song and give it a three-dimensional life.
Right.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, as much of the show was, to be perfectly honest with you, it really was a matter of just saying, what do you think? And then you'd sit with Feet's Too Big in particular. I think Arthur and Murray, and probably Richard as well, came up with the idea of me sitting at a table and singing the number about somebody. I thought, well, okay, that sounds... And I asked for it. I said, well, can I sing it to someone? And they said, what do you mean? You want one of the girls to sit there? I said, oh, no, I don't want anybody to be there. I just want... Just give me an empty chair so I can see the woman that I'm talking about in that case. So that's how that happened as far as what the physical thing was. And you know, the number was the same. I mean, not a lot was changed. I think it was a couple of asides and things put in. But I think by making it a theater number and not just a song,
yeah,
and having a point of view and a point of reference, mm, it changed it into an actual theater, mm-hmm, performance number.
Right.
But with a lot of the numbers we were given, because, you know, I credit us with saying this, and I always like to say it because I think it's fair. We were five very, very, let's put it this, we were supporting people in most of the shows we'd been in. So we were very dynamic, character-driven people, mm, which meant we were used to building characters and making things, right, that were very real for ourselves and so forth. And that's when you put five people like that together, you've got a really tremendous lot, mm, of creativity going on. And a lot of it came from us. Mm. You know, and that's not in deference to Richard because he thought, nope, of the whole thing and he hired us. But a lot of it really did come from our personalities, obviously, yeah, and our personifications of ourselves and people we knew and grandparents and aunts and uncles, right, and things like that to create those people. And more than anything, of course, bringing whatever you could bring of Fats's personality and ideology, his humor and stuff, mm-hmm, into those roles. Of course, for me, it was direct because I bore the resemblance and that, but and yet I still wasn't playing him.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. So it was very interesting to watch the creative. I was telling this company, I just directed a production of it out at La Mirada in California, cool. Kathy Rigby's company.
Oh, wow.
Really great cast. I got to give them some props. Great cast. But I was telling them how some of the things happened, you know, the history of it. And a couple of them had done the show and stuff, but they didn't know all the background.
Sure, sure.
So I was telling about Squeeze Me, the woman who does Armelia in the show. I said, you would not believe how that happened. It was the end of the day. We all wanted to go home, and they hadn't worked, sung through Squeeze Me yet. And they said, oh, Armelia, we just want to go through Squeeze Me before you go. And she was like, oh, I want to go home. I'm tired. I want to go home. And they said, no, just sing through it once so we can know what we have to deal with musically. So she leaned up against the wall by the piano and put her hands behind her back and just said, oh, Daddy, squeeze me and squeeze me. And we all, you know, you look around the room, we're all looking at each other going, that's amazing. That's yeah, it.
That's it. That's
and Arthur was like, it's magic. It's magic. And Richard went, that's perfectly fine. You know, it's this thing. And I remember we got to the end, and Andre DeShields said, Diva, at the end, bat your eyes. Just bat your eyes. She went, what? And go back, sing the ending again. She went, when you squeeze me. And she just batted. And he went, that's it. That's it. And it never changed. That was it.
So there was a real collaboration.
Absolutely.
With everybody.
Absolutely.
In that room.
So when it went to Broadway, I mean, right, she sang it like that at the Manhattan Theater because she just leaned against the wall and sang the song. And when they went to Broadway, I remember Richard saying, we can't lose that. We have to find a way to keep that. So that became the thing of turning her around on the piano and her leaning against the back of the piano. So we kept, they kept, oh, wow, it was kept, of her leaning, just standing there and just singing against the quote-unquote wall.
What do you mean you didn't know Girl Scouts deliver? They do, yes. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love.
And with us today is the author of that chapter, Richard Duenez Morrison. Mr. Morrison is a music director and voice teacher in San Diego, California. He holds a bachelor's degree in stage management from Webster University and a master's degree in musical theater from San Diego State University. Richard, I'm so happy that you're here with us today. And my first question for you is, who was Fats Waller and what were his contributions to the world of entertainment?
Well, Fats Waller basically was one of the first musical superstars of the modern era, of the jazz era. Of he really got big in the late 1920s as a writer and a performer. Ain't Misbehavin' is all songs that he either wrote, co-wrote, or at least performed. He had some role in it. He definitely did not write all of the songs. I mean, he had different collaborators in terms of writing over the years. He always wrote the music, and he had lyricists. But some of the songs in the show, he simply recorded and popularized. He became famous for playing Harlem stride piano. He was a well-known performer, not just a songwriter. Not to use the word just, but you know what I mean. But he was a personality. He was a force of nature. He was so jolly and jocular and... he was a physically large man with a large personality. He loved, you know, the cliche, wine, women, and song. That's absolutely who he was. He had a large appetite for all things in life. He absolutely, you know, lived life to his fullest. Forgive the cliche. Ultimately, that's probably what killed him. He caught pneumonia at the age of 39 and died on a train crossing the country to a gig. But he toured the country. He toured internationally. He absolutely helped popularize Harlem Stride piano. At the height of the Harlem Renaissance, he was right there. He was a big part of that community. And his trademark, one of his trademarks was, you know, he's performing a song like, say, Honeysuckle Rose, and, you know, he's playing and singing, and in between the lyrical phrases, he's interjecting. You know, he's saying jokes, he's commenting. So it was, he kind of never stopped making noise. He was just this person that just kind of kept going, and I don't think anyone had seen somebody like that before. And he became really popular around the world.
In the terms of the Harlem Renaissance and all the great artists that came out, musically, how would you compare him to, say, somebody like Duke Ellington or Count Basie?
Aha, good question. I'm gonna use Duke Ellington because, to me, Duke Ellington, his sort of image and his musical style was such sophistication. You know, Duke Ellington had his orchestra. He was very to me, Duke Ellington just was so, like, not just upper class, not only upper class, but, like, that's what Duke Ellington was about. When I think of Duke Ellington, I think of sort of elegance, a sophistication to the music and the image. Whereas I think Fats Waller was very, he was very working class. He became known for, he would play piano at rent parties. His musical artistic voice was very much the voice of everyday people. He was so, his artistic voice was so down to earth. He wrote about and performed songs that were about everyday things. I'm thinking of Cash for Your Trash, like selling, you know, kitchenware. I think I said that in my chapter, selling kitchenware for the war effort to make money. Lost love and being jealous. But, like, always in a playful way, always in a very, just everyday way. His lyrics weren't, they were fun and they were joyful and they could be heartbreaking, but they weren't what I would call elevated, in the best way. You know, I think a lot of people connected with him for that reason.
And when Ain't Misbehavin' emerges in the late 70s, do you happen to know where Fats Waller was in the national consciousness? Did people remember him? Had he been eclipsed by somebody like, say, Duke Ellington or Count Basie? Or what? Where exactly was he in the terms of, like, everyone's collective memory?
That's a great question. He was not very much in everyone's collective memory. He very much had been largely forgotten. When Richard Maltby Jr. and Murray Horowitz, his associate director, when they were doing the research to put together the show, they had such a hard time. They really had to dig to find a lot of the works, to get hard copies of the sheet music. I mean, I can't imagine. I was barely not alive at the time. But, like, you know, now everything's online, you know, in some form. And not only was everything hard copy back then, but a lot of Fats Waller's work had been lost. When he was alive, he died in 1943, by the way. When he was alive, he had such a penchant for spending money, he was often selling his songs just to make money, just to pay his bills. So he sold a lot of his songs to other people. Back in the day, especially at that time, there was a habit of Black writers would sell songs, and then they would sell the rights to their songs, but then the songs would, they would hear of their songs or see their song later somewhere credited to another author, probably a white author.
So let's talk a little bit about, we know that Ain't Misbehavin', after reading your chapter, we know that Ain't Misbehavin' changed the way reviews were performed in New York City, at least. Can you tell us a little bit what reviews were like prior to Ain't Misbehavin' coming on the scene.
Yeah, they had been larger. They had been basically spectacle-based. Like I said, you know, dancing choruses, costumes, more about the artifice and the spectacle, less, I think, about the humanity. I think the most obvious difference was the larger cast, usually with a fuller orchestra. And they hadn't been... the reviews back in, like, the first part of the 20th century were often written by a lot... there were songs from a lot of different artists. Mm-hmm. What we think of now, what we take for granted as jukebox musicals, in the 70s, they were starting to kind of come back a bit. They certainly weren't as popular as they are now, but in the 70s, there was Yubi. Oh, Yubi is a great example.
Oh, yeah, Yubi's great.
The songs of Yubi Blake. That was a larger, a physically larger show. It didn't do as well. That was certainly a jukebox musical, but that was a physically larger show. A lot of people attribute that show's sort of lack of success, being the music itself was not as accessible to the audience in the 70s, or rather the treatment of Yubi's music in that show. It didn't land with the 70s audience as much. There certainly was, I know Bubbling Brown Sugar was a big hit. That ran for a couple of years.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And one of the things I think is that's so interesting about the structure of Ain't Misbehavin', and maybe you can shed some light on this, is it seems like reviews prior to Ain't Misbehavin' were the shows that we call And Then He Wrote, so that there really was no story to it. It was people in tuxedos and evening gowns coming in, singing, here's the song that he made famous, but there was no story. How did they craft a story for Ain't Misbehavin' without using any dialogue?
Well, they basically decided, like most reviews, we're not going to have an overarching story, but each song is going to be a very clear story, very theatrical in its storytelling, both staging and musically. They wanted to, Maltby and Horwitz wanted to evoke the world of Fats Waller. They didn't want to recreate it. They wanted to sort of represent it, give us a sense of it. They wanted these five performers to be basically consistent characters, and they wanted these five characters to have backstories so that they had relationships, and every different combination of these five performers was a different story and a different relationship or set of relationships, if that makes sense. I think that approach, combined with the brilliance of the performers themselves, really is what sold the show. So they created this world and these specific people, and we watched these people go through new circumstances every, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 minutes.
Was Ain't Misbehavin' created specifically to be on Broadway?
No, absolutely not. It was originally Maltby and Horwitz wanted to create a biographical musical of Fats Waller's life, and they were doing the research, and they basically were like, okay, he died at 43 and he was at the height of his career, so it's really an act one of a story. There was no act two. So they were like, okay. Oh, actually, I believe it was Lynn Meadow, artistic director of Manhattan Theater Club at the time, who said to them, hey, do a cabaret we have an opening in our season. If you want to do a review of Fats Waller's songs, you can do that and it'll run a month. So they did that. And then that's where the idea for the show came from. And they took their left turn and made a review. And the theater, the cabaret space at MTC was like 60 seats. And it sold out, got rave reviews, and producers were fighting to be the ones to take it to Broadway.
Let's talk about this, or cast of then unknowns.
Oh my gosh.
That they got to be in this show. Can you walk us through this cast?
Oh my gosh, it's incredible. The three females were Armelia McQueen, who recently passed, sadly. I believe it was last year. Nell Carter, who passed several years ago. Of course, she went on to probably become arguably probably the most famous one of the cast. She became like a TV star, really, with Give Me a Break in the 80s and other things. Charlaine Woodard. And then the two males were Andre DeShields, the icon, the Broadway icon. Oh, my God. And Ken Page. I mean, all these people went on to have such wonderful, fascinating careers, both mostly on stage, also on screen.
One of the things that I would love to talk about is why did Maltby decide to have five performers as opposed to an even six, so you could have three pairs of couples?
Ain't Misbehavin' was originally going to be one woman and two men. And in the casting process, Maltby found Armelia McQueen and Nell Carter, and he literally could not decide between which of them to have as his star. So he decided to change the number of cast members and use both of them and then have two men and then a third woman. He wanted an odd number. So there would be, you know, so the couples couldn't really be matched up, you know, so there was always a different combination of people. And there was always someone, you know, the third wheel, the fifth wheel, you know, so there could be lots of comedic conflict and just different stories. Every story was so compelling. I'll never forget Nell Carter singing... Mean to Me changed my life. I have just never seen anything like it. And then you have something like Your Feet's Too Big, you know, just opposite end of the spectrum. And I don't know, it was... I had never seen anything quite like this world presented in this way with these insanely skilled performers and just staged... to go just boom, 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 one thing to the next, so clearly and simply.
One of the things you also talk about in your chapter, which I thought was so fascinating, was that the characters in the show were really based on the personalities of the actors in the rehearsal room.
And if you look in the score, the libretto, it, you know, the characters are named the original five actors, you know, it's Andre, Armelia, etc. And they did really create the show in the rehearsal process of the cabaret. They really created it together. They didn't go in with, you know, Andre's going to do this and Armelia's going to do this. They figured it out. So my understanding is when you mount the show now, yes, these sort of templates are there for the characters, but there's absolutely room to bring you as the performer to it.
What are some of the benefits, would you say, going into a rehearsal saying, hey, I know I'm using you five individuals, I just don't know what anyone's doing right yet? Are there advantages or disadvantages to that sort of freedom, which is so antithetical to how we do shows today?
I know, right? I know, it's hard to imagine, especially with the review of so much material.
Yes.
I think it depends on who you ask, but certainly there's going to be pros and cons. The pro being that you can tailor it to who you have in the room.
One of the quotes that I found so fascinating in your chapter was Richard Maltby saying, I'm the king of reviews because I don't like reviews.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes.
Because that's all he's that's not all he's done. But as a director, that's what he's primarily known for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he directed the two musicals that were... because he directed Fosse, which is... Yes, Fosse and Ain't Misbehavin', the two reviews that won Best Musical. I'm trying to think if there's any others. I don't know, is Contact a review?
No, technically no.
Okay.
It feels like it is, but technically they say
how
no.
How is it technically not?
Because
that's all pre-recorded.
It's all pre-recorded. There is a book to it, believe it or not.
I saw it. I don't remember it well.
Yeah,
no,
it's
no
a movie... No. Listen, I think it's a very moving dance piece. Yes, I think it's a very moving dance piece. But
yes, agreed.
Yeah, it was a slim season that year. Slim season that year.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, but I remember in my research going, oh, wow, the only two reviews that have won the Tony for Best Musical happen to be directed by Richard Maltby Jr.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of nuts. Between that and Closer Than Ever, Starting Here, Starting Now, yeah, he's known for his reviews. And I appreciate that he doesn't, quote unquote, doesn't like reviews, because he's like, how can we make this interesting? How can we make every moment part of a story? You know, and I mean, my life is musical theater, and I will basically agree with him. I don't, reviews are not, it's not a place, it's not a style I pursue, you know?
And why is that?
Because it's hard to make, you know, 20 or 30 songs in a row. You know, it's hard to keep an audience engaged for 2 hours. It really is, I think. I don't want to say anything bad and anything negative about any other pieces, but I'm working on a show right now. It's a review, and it's a known review. And literally, like, in preparing right now for this podcast, I was thinking, oh, the show that I'm doing now, I can see where it could have done a couple of the things that Ain't Misbehavin' did. I think it would have been more compelling. So I'll just say that.
No, of course. And can you identify what some of the things that Ain't Misbehavin' does very well that you wish other reviews, regardless of whatever you're working on, other reviews would implement into their structure?
First off the top of my head, Ain't Misbehavin' doesn't have that many ballads. It really moves. And as much as I love ballads, I think that was really smart of them. The show that I'm doing right now, I think one of its flaws is that it has too many ballads, and they are beautiful, brilliant works of storytelling, these songs. But I think this review has too many ballads, and we lose the audience here and there.
Totally understand. Totally understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think Ain't Misbehavin' does really well, and you mentioned this in your chapter, is it creates a template for how best to do a review. And if you follow the template that it lays out, you should be in pretty good shape. The abundance of up-tempo songs, the uneven casting, bringing the personalities out to the forefront. And one of the things I found so interesting in your chapter was the cross-section of humanity, as you call it, in terms of the casting.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
So all these five actors, they looked different. They sounded different. The two men, Ken Page and André DeShields, I mean, they're so different from each other. Very different voices. Ken Page is a large man. André DeShields is a smaller man. André DeShields has kind of like a bright, I would almost say reedy voice, fascinating voice, so unique. Ken Page has more of a rich baritone. And of course, they can both do so many different things within those sounds that they have. But they were so different from each other. The three women, Armelia, Nell, and Charlaine, they were different types. Charlaine was kind of like the skinny, kind of ditzy one. I mean, to really oversimplify it. And she had a broad vocal range. Armelia McQueen was like, kind of, to me, she was the most sophisticated of all five of them. Her character certainly was kind of trying to be sophisticated, elegant, a little upper crust, maybe a little snobby at times. She was the soprano, you know. Nell had that trumpet voice that just was like, sounded like it was coming right through her nose, but in the best way. And Nell was, I think, more down to earth, more of a down to earth character. Nell and Armelia, specifically as the larger women, physically as the plus size women, I think I say this in my chapter, they are really, it was maybe one of the first times in a hit Broadway musical where large women, and who happened to be black, but large women were seen as sexually desirable, as beautiful, as elegant, as sexy. Not only were they seen as that within their world, but they had desires. You know, they clearly had sex lives. They clearly were dating and, you know, seeing these different men. And that was new at the time.
And not played for laughs.
Exactly. Thank you. That's a great point. Right? I think still to this day, very much you see larger women, they're only allowed to be comedians. Yep. I think most of the time. So back then that was a new thing. And yes, these women were funny, but they were also so real in so many ways. Like I mentioned before, Mean to Me, you know, Nell Carter, that beautiful heartbreaking song she sings. You know, she wasn't just a comedian, this larger woman, we could shed a tear for her and her story of love, lost love.
Had Ain't Misbehavin' stayed off Broadway at Manhattan Theater Club, it would have been still groundbreaking because it's giving us a successful template on how to do a review. But it moves to Broadway. Why take this thing that's praised for its intimacy and put it in a 1,052 seat Broadway theater?
Well, money, of course. Why anything on Broadway? Money.
Who doesn't love money?
I know, right? It was something new that had, I would say arguably, had not been seen before. And why wouldn't, you know, a lot of producers want to make that commercial. I think the success of the show on Broadway was due to Maltby and friends absolutely keeping the integrity of the show, not quote unquote opening it up, expanding it for the larger stage and the larger house. They kept the design simple. They kept the cast what it was, who they were. I obviously didn't see the MTC Cabaret production, but if you watch the PBS filming of the original production, it's small, you know? So it just really sounds like they absolutely kept the heart of the show.
So this show, it goes to Broadway, really against all odds, like you're saying, because you would assume that if you're a ticket buyer in 1978, you're probably going, who's Fats Waller? There's only five people I've never heard of in this thing.
Yep.
What is this? And and rejecting it. But not only does it go to Broadway, not only does it get fantastic reviews, can you tell me a little bit about the upset at the Tony Awards?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was up against On the 20th Century, specifically, this way more traditional book show. It was an operetta, basically kind of a combination between an operetta and a musical comedy, directed by Hal Prince with Madeline Kahn, for crying out loud, movie star, John Cullum, a young Kevin Kline, Imogene Coca, another huge star, you know. And it was, by all accounts, well received and did very well that season. So that was its main competition. There was also Dancin', the Bob Fosse review, which was more along the lines of what reviews had always been. Even though that was largely dance, it was a spectacle, you know. And that show actually ran for years, too. That became one of the longest running musicals ever. So just no one expected this little show that maybe from the outside, I don't know, seemed a little niche. Maybe because it was black, maybe some ignorant people thought that, I don't know, but it just had such more traditionally successful competition, you know?
And what message does it send to potential commercial producers? Hey, no matter how big or how starry the names are on a project, like On the 20th Century, we're going in this direction. What is that telling future producers?
It's about the material. It's about the product. It's about there's different things that compel people. We don't just need names. We don't just need formats that we know already and are used to and familiar with. We can break the mold a little bit.
What are some other things that have been created because of Ain't Misbehavin'?
Oh my gosh. Well, something I forgot to mention earlier was I draw a direct line between Ain't Misbehavin' and these larger desirable women. Fast forward a few years to Dreamgirls and Effie White, you know, the lead in Dreamgirls. I mean, part of the plot of that show is the fact that she is a plus size woman. And what that does to her career. But just like Ain't Misbehavin', in Dreamgirls, she is seen as a desirable woman by some of those men. And she has desires, you know. We see her love life play out for better and for worse. So that, in terms of book shows even, that happened. And we all know, you know, how huge how huge Dreamgirls was. In terms of what else that came after it, gosh, I mean, Ain't Misbehavin' was the first jukebox musical of any size to win the Tony for Best Musical. So, I mean, now I think we take jukebox musicals for granted. I mean, it, also in the early 80s, though, there was Sophisticated Ladies, the Duke Ellington jukebox musical. That was more traditional in its spectacle. What else was there? Oh, there was Black and Blue in the later 80s. And that actually, people don't talk about that show ever anymore, but that had a great run. And that was a review of basically black culture and music in Paris between the two world wars. But then, I mean, look at Smokey Joe's Cafe in the 90s. I believe that still is the longest running review on Broadway history. But then, God, I'm jumping around, I know, time-wise.
No, this is exactly great.
There are so many, but it's like, think of all the Gershwin jukebox musicals that have come since then. My One and Only in the early 80s, Crazy for You in the early 90s, Nice Work, you know, several years ago, American in Paris, all these Gershwin, you know, jukebox musicals. What else? Oh my God, Cats. I mentioned that in my book, or in the chapter. I mean, Cats has taken some T.S. Eliot poems and making in all those songs, you know, slash poems became individual stories, and each character has its song, has its story. You know, I mean, I think it was a huge, Ain't Misbehavin' absolutely was a huge wave that moved towards those other things, whether they be black stories or not black stories, whatever kind of jukebox musical review.
Richard, thank you so much for getting the chance to speak with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and the chapter is fantastic. Let's hope that we'll see more productions of Ain't Misbehavin' soon, so people can revisit the brilliance of this show.
Seriously, yeah.
Listeners, please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about Ain't Misbehavin', please also review the links in the below description. I'm Robert Schneider, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast. Bye-bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.